You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning, everyone. We will now continue our program. And my name is Lisbeth Steer. I am a fellow at the Center for Universal Education here at Brookings, and I will be moderating this session. So our key question today, as we heard in our previous panel, is really how we are going to scale learning across the world. And as we discussed earlier, actually, this involves two things. The first is we need to get those children that are currently out of school into school, and there are about 57 million children at the basic level currently out of school. Secondly, we need to get those children that are in school to require the right skills. And estimates say that there are currently about 250 million children that are actually in school but not learning. We were already discussing this earlier. In this session, we will look at how governments can use their own resources to achieve these goals. And we all know that domestic public finance is by far the largest and most important source of finance for education. And over the last decade, resources through the public sector have increased dramatically in developing countries. Between 1990 and 2011, spending on education went up from around 3.1% of GDP to 4.1% of GDP. And that's a large number if you calculate the growth of those countries as well. And this is wonderful news. But increasing the level of spending is not the only challenge. A perhaps even bigger challenge is how you then actually go and allocate those resources to the children within the countries. And so for a moment, imagine you're the Minister of Education or you're the Minister of Finance. How are you going to allocate your resources? We heard a lot of interesting kind of ways earlier. But if we look around the world at how governments do this, we basically find there's sort of three principles that guide allocations. One is finance can be allocated based on fairness. Every child gets an equal amount of money. It can be allocated based on need, even though we know that disadvantaged children will have much greater needs. And third, money can be allocated based on impact. So where is the biggest bang for your buck? Now, in school finance literature, actually, people refer to this as equity, adequacy, and effectiveness. Most countries have a combination of these different principles in the way they allocate. So governments will have to answer a number of questions with regards to this. On equity, they have to think about, do we allocate based on the number of students, or do we allocate based on the number of children, whether they're in school or out of school? On needs, to what extent do we allocate resources to disadvantaged groups? How much more do we give them? What's an adequate level to allocate to disadvantaged groups? On impact, what kind of programs are going to deliver the biggest results? And what kind of incentives can be built into the system to produce those results? There are lots of questions out there. Governments also have to think about, what do we do with donor money? How do we calculate that into the allocation? These are difficult questions, and all well-meaning educators and governments are trying to struggle with them. We know that in many countries, sadly, the current allocation mechanisms are not producing the results we need. In fact, they're producing the opposite. Things are getting worse. Inequities are being exacerbated by the way money is allocated. Wealthier children tend to receive a lot more public money than poorer ones. We've been working in Bangladesh and found that some districts receive 10 times as much public resources than other districts. How do we kind of put that all together, and how can we do better? So the question for us today is, what kind of financing models are needed to get those 57 million children into school and to get all children learning? And no one is better placed to help us with this question than Julia Gillard. Julia was already introduced earlier, but I wanted to highlight the role she played in spearheading reforms of the education financing system in Australia. During Julia's time as education minister, she commissioned a major assessment of Australia's financing system that formed the basis for the reforms. And as prime minister, she was also able to put these recommendations and reforms into practice. It's an incredible honor, Julia, to be working with you here at Brookings. And we are very thrilled to have you with us today. Please, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much to Elizabeth for that introduction, and it's a great pleasure to be able to speak at this session. What I was intending to do on this ugly subject of money is describe to you the Australian reform experience and to try and draw some insights out of that which may be useful for other nations in other contexts. To do that, I just need to give you some very brief background on the Australian education system. Australia, obviously a vast landmass, teaching around 3.6 million students in 9,500 schools, schools in obviously urban settings, but right through to outback locations. Our schooling system has both public and private components. Public education, state schools are predominantly financed by state governments, our six state and two territory governments. The federal government plays some role historically in their funding, but overwhelmingly financed by state governments. Then we have a private schooling system. The word private actually masks the fact that each of those schools also receives some public money, historically predominantly from the federal government, and then parents pay private contributions, fees, to have their children educated in those schools. When you look at the proportions overall, roughly about two-thirds of Australian students are educated in state government schools, one-third are educated in non-government schools. That does mask a little bit that in primary education, overwhelmingly children are going to state government schools. But by the time you are reaching the upper end of secondary education, people are often choosing the private alternative for the last few years of their child's education, and so the proportions are different at that stage. When we compare our education system with the standards of the world, Australia has a good education system. If you're going to look at PISA or TIMSS or any of those international measures, but when I became education minister, there were already some troubling signs coming out of those international testing regimes. First and foremost, we were starting to slip back in the rankings. Now, that wasn't an absolute decline in standards, but a relative decline in standards. Other nations were improving more quickly than Australia was. And then a persistent problem when we looked at ourselves in those international tests was that we had a long tail of disadvantage, that for a high-income country, 12th biggest economy in the world, we had too many children from poorer backgrounds, Indigenous children particularly, who were being left behind. So the gaps in education for those children, they could easily be 2 or 3 years behind Australian children generally in their achievement levels at school. So when I became Education Minister, I wanted to change this. And in order to change it, we really needed first and foremost to find out what was going on in Australian education. We had the international testing data, but we didn't have anything more finer grained which would tell us what was actually happening in schools. As I said a little bit earlier today, we had plenty of prejudices. We had advocates of public education who would say, the problem is too much money goes to private schools. We're teaching the disadvantaged kids. If you just changed that, took some money off private schools and gave it to us, everything would be fixed. You had private schools who were saying, well, really, we're alleviating burdens from taxpayers because parents are putting money into their children's education because those kids come to our schools. So if you just had more private schools, everything would be fixed. And so the politics of education in Australia was really about contending sectors, public versus private. And as a result, about contending governments, because the federal government was overwhelmingly financing the private schools and state governments were overwhelmingly financing state schools. So the state governments would say, it's all the federal government's fault, you're putting too much money into private education. And the federal government would say, well, we fund schools that are doing well, why can't you state governments do the same? So lots of adults, private, public, state, federal, having a wonderful conversation amongst themselves. Meanwhile, of course, in the actual schools, there were too many children who weren't achieving the kind of learning outcomes that we wanted them to achieve. So the first thing that I did as Education Minister, and it was a very controversial call, is I said, let's not talk about school systems anymore, public or private. Let's actually get real-time data on what is happening in every school, public and private. So let's shift our gaze from the school sectors to individual schools and find out what's happening in each individual school. So we created a data set which ended up being publicly available through a website called My School. So I'd invite you, when you've got some time, to go on that website, anybody can, and you can look school by school in Australia about what is happening in those schools. What you will find on that website is, first and foremost, you will find national testing results. So on the same day, every year, kids across Australia in grades 3, 5, 7 and 9 do literacy and numeracy tests. And we will be adding to that with science testing as well. Then all of that data is made available, of course, to teachers. It's it's a well-designed test, so it gives diagnostic information about how children are going. It provides a report card to those children's parents so they can see how their kids are going too. But the information is also made transparently available school by school. So you can see how your school is going. Now, if that's all the website gave you, it wouldn't really be that useful because you don't need a website, you don't even need national testing to tell you that in Australia, it is very likely that the children who go to the most elite private schools are scoring well in literacy and numeracy. And unfortunately, it is also far too likely that Indigenous children going to outback schools are scoring badly. Now, it doesn't have to be like that. Those kids can all get great educations and get great results. But if you just had that testing, that's what it would tell you. Therefore, the website also gives you a series of measures about the level of advantage or disadvantage of children at that school. Those measures are generated against parental income, highest education level of the parents of the kids, the number of Indigenous children in the school, the number of non-English speaking children in the school, the number of children with disabilities in the school, and all of this is weighted to give one score, a particular score, which gives you a level of advantage or disadvantage. That means that we then had My School, so you could not only look at how an individual school is going in literacy and numeracy against Australian averages, you could also look at how that school is going against schools that teach similar students. So it started to be a tool to identify best practice and underperformance. If two schools teaching similar kids, one is getting great results, one's getting really bad results, then you can go into the great school and say, what are these guys doing right, so we can share it. You can go into the school that is underperforming and say, what do we need to do to lift up the performance of this school? But then that brought us to the ugly subject of money. Because, of course, another variable that can impact on school performance is how many resources, how much money that school has available to it for the task of teaching the children. And so we added to My School, by school, breaking down and making transparently available the amount of money that school spends each year in educating children in that school. Now, that sounds easy to say. It was pretty hard to do. It was easy to do for independent schools, which weren't in school systems, because the dollars coming in from government, some from government parental fees spent in the school on the task of educating the kids, also spent on things like maintenance and payroll and professional development and all of the things that you need to do to run an entity like a school. For state government schools, those things like maintenance and payroll and professional development were actually paid for out of the state departments of education. So if you're going to end up comparing like with like, you needed to break down those head office costs and attribute them to schools as part of that school's amount of money that was going to educating the children. That in and of itself provoked a grand conversation when school principals for the first time in state schools could say, "You're really telling me that the services I notionally get from the State Department of Education are worth this amount of money? You're really trying to tell me that?" So there were some quite fevered conversations between school principals and State Departments of Education, which I think is all to the good, because central bureaucracy should be under pressure about the quality of the services and support that they're providing. So you then had on the one website results, the nature of the children in the school, the advantages and disadvantages they brought to school, and the amount of money being invested in their education. I wanted to get it to that stage because I always thought that if we had a data set where we could point to schools and say, these schools are teaching similar kids, the teachers are of similar quality, one is getting a bad result, one is getting a good result, and guess what? The school that's got the good result has got more money in it. What is that telling us, the adults? It's telling us that money makes a difference and we've really got an obligation to add more money to the school that is underperforming. And My School does give you the ability to do that. Even as we were building the website, we created a number of new funding streams and particularly worked in disadvantaged schools and tracked the changes so that we could forensically show that if you added more money with an appropriate change agenda, you could lift learning outcomes on literacy and numeracy sometimes by as much as 30%. So we ended up breaking down the funding conversation from being about contending school sectors to what do we need to do in individual schools. That enabled us to then have the information to make a long-term change to our funding model. Our funding model was opaque. There was no one in Australia sitting in a school who could really explain to you exactly how all of the funding was working, and it wasn't needs-based. So we asked an eminent group of Australians to provide us with a report on changing the funding model. And if my first insight is get a clear picture of what's going on to help drive change, my second insight would be often if you're going to get experts to advise, it pays to get people who are not necessarily immersed in the current system. So the experts we got were not people from education. They were leading business people, a range of experts who were coming to this with fresh eyes. And what they ended up doing was creating a number of reference schools, around 80 reference schools, schools that were teaching children that conformed to the Australian average in terms of income profile, occupational profile of parents. They looked at those schools teaching average children, if I can use that terminology, that were getting good results. And they worked out what is the per capita spend that you need for a child that comes from an average background to ensure that child gets good schooling and good results at school. That became what we called the base of the school resource standard. So we said every school teaching children from average backgrounds should have that amount of money available to it. But to complete the school resource standard, it was then recommended to us and we implemented that there be loadings on top to recognise the factors that mean you need more effort to teach a child to a great standard. So on top of that, a loading for disadvantage measured by a socioeconomic index, parental occupation, income, a loading for children from non-English speaking backgrounds, a loading for Indigenous children, and a loading for students with disabilities. There was also changes in the school resource standard if you were in a small school, because obviously the fixed costs are amortised over a smaller student base, or in a remote school, because in remote Australia, just given the distances, everything costs more, including the salary rates necessary to pay teachers to have them teach in such locations. That is the school funding model that we are moving Australian education to, a school resource standard with these loadings. But it had to work across both the state school system and the private system. So in the private system, everybody, we wanted every child in the private system to have the benefit of the school resource standard, but there was built into the model an assessment of parental capacity to pay, an assessment of the income of the parents sending their kids to that school. Depending on where they were on the income gradient, the higher their income, the less public contribution there was. The lower their income, the higher public contribution there was. And there are schools in Australia that are non-government schools teaching very disadvantaged populations, and so they are getting a very high public contribution and the fees are very low. But even with that, we made sure for all schools, public and private, that the loadings, for example, the loading for disadvantage was 100% publicly funded. So there is no reason for a non-government school to not enrol a disadvantaged student. They're not going to be there saying, well, if I start enrolling all these disadvantaged students, their education's going to cost more. I'm going to end up diverting money from the other kids to supplement the education of these children because that supplement is coming from the government. Now, in Lisbeth's very elegant outline, what are the elements of that funding model? Well, the elements of it are a per capita consideration. We wanted every child, as part of their citizenship entitlement, to have some public resources directed towards their education. A needs-based model, so for children who we know have greater needs and will require greater investment to have a great education, that the system is responding to that through the loadings. And we also wanted it to be incredibly transparent so that for any school in Australia at any time you could assess what money is going in and why it is going in, so that there were no special deals, no political arrangements that had been added on as a result of election promises or pledges, but complete transparency. Where are we in this journey? Well, the model is still in implementation. It has a 6-year phase in. There have been some consequences from the change of government, but the model will be phased in full in many parts of Australia. And I think whatever else happens in Australian education, we most certainly will not ever go back to a model that doesn't have at its base a school resource standard and loadings for disadvantage. So I think once you make the big shift, it is a shift that ends up being sustainable over time. People work in all sorts of different contexts. We obviously work in one where access is not an issue. We've got universal access. We're a country that, by world standards, has high income and the ability, therefore, to have large-scale expenditure on public services, including education. But I think that there are some things that are robust enough to come from our experience for other contexts. Transparency matters. transparency helps drive change, and making sure that we correlate and can understand the intersections between learning, disadvantage and financing matter. What the ultimate financing model will vary enormously from place to place, but it needs to stack up in that correlation as something that is fair and will make a long-term difference for the education of students. So thank you very much, and I'll look forward to participating in the panel. Thank you.
Thank you so much. This was really fascinating and sets us off to a brilliant start. I'll now continue with introducing the rest of our panel here. I'm first on next to Julia on my left here is Daniel Encada. Daniel is a Basic Education Commissioner at the Ministry of Education in Uganda. In his role, he oversees the formulation and implementation of policies for primary education. Uganda, and he will talk about this, has introduced universal primary education and universal secondary education. So a lot of very good experience there. Daniel has also worked as a teacher, a school head, district government official, so he knows all levels of the school system. Thank you so much for joining us, Daniel. Next to Daniel is Harry Petrinos. Harry is an education manager at the World Bank and is one of the best-known analysts in the world on these questions of finance and equity and education. He's led several studies across the world on education financing, including on decentralization and demand-side financing. Harry has also managed education lending operations and studied the impact of education interventions. And then next to Harry, we have Fazli Rabbani. Fazli is a senior education specialist in Bangladesh working with DFID. Fazli has a keen interest in how governance and public finance systems affect marginalized groups, and he's also been overseeing a study on funding allocations in Bangladesh, and we've had the pleasure to work with him on that. So having introduced the panel, I'd like to proceed now with the first segment of the discussion where I will ask some questions and ask each of the panelists to respond, and then we'll move on to a discussion with the audience. So I'll start with Daniel. Daniel, as I mentioned earlier, Uganda has implemented some really significant reforms introducing universal primary education and universal secondary education. What have been the biggest challenges for your government in terms of providing equal education opportunities for disadvantaged groups, and how have resources played a role in there? So what has been your model in terms of reaching the marginalized? Yes, you can press the button.
Thank you very much, Tia. I greet everybody. Yes, you have rightly said Uganda has had universal primary education since 1997. And when we thought that the children from this universal primary education were now graduating to secondary, then we introduced the universal secondary education to accommodate those children who are graduating from primary subsector. There have been a number of challenges. Because we started with universal primary education, we thought we would start with 4 children per family, but we ended up taking everybody because it was difficult to choose the 4. Parents were saying, now these are my children, these are my children. How do you take these 4 so they could register under a brother would register the others, and then this one would. So we ended up taking on all the children. And it was really enormous, and it was pressing too hard on the economy because it had not been planned for. And we did not take on classes per classes, but we took everybody in the primary subsector, primary 1 to primary 7. So it really brought a head-on collision with the finances, which were very, very limited. The challenges, therefore, one, the planning became a problem because the numbers were increasing every other year. Our birth rates in Uganda are the highest almost in the world. The fertility rate of our female is the highest almost in the world. So we have big numbers. When we started UPE, it was 2 million. The first year, it shot to 6 million children when everybody that was left out entered school. But of course, this one included even some of the old people who wanted to partake of the opportunity. So inadequate budgetary provision is one of the biggest challenge. When it comes to the specialized groups, we have the HIV AIDS children, we have the HIV AIDS parents. All this affects this program of UPE and that affects the universal secondary education programs, because when children lose their parents, some of them become they become children-led families and they have nobody to help them. And availability of correct statistical data for planning purposes is a big problem, getting the right data. And once you have wrong data, then the planning becomes a problem. How do we do this? We send forms to primary schools. We send forms to secondary schools. They fill in the available data with them, but there is a lot of dishonesty. So they fill in because they know we are sending money to schools according to the number of students. Therefore, they take advantage of putting in children who are not there, students who are not there. Therefore, we have a bulk of information which is not real good for us to help in the planning. Then another challenge is the insurgency or war situations. We had in the northern part of the country, we had it running for 20 years. So all the infrastructure in that area, all the children were being kept in camps. It was a real problem for the country, and it has cost us a lot. So we had to have schools shifting, joining together in a camp to cater for these children for all those years. Now, when it subsided, then we had to take these children back to where the schools were. Therefore, that meant putting other infrastructure, putting the necessary materials, and then reallocation of these parents to where they are. And you know, there is also the psychological effects that that follow these kind of children, these kind of parents. So all these have been major challenges. We have got areas for purposes of equity that are on islands. These islands have got small number of the inhabitants are few, and therefore they are few children. You cannot put a school on every small island. So you have to construct boarding schools on one of the islands and get these children from wherever they are and put them in these boarding facilities. It's a big challenge because universal primary education, we intended to have them in day school because the costs are low. But in such areas, we find ourselves having boarding schools. In fact, in some of them, we have not been able to put enough of these boarding schools. We have other areas that are geographically disadvantaged, semi-arid, where parents are nomads, kind of. They move from one place to another looking for grass for their animals. This is particularly Karamoja. This one is a thorn in the neck on the economy. Because, one, we have to feed the children. And in that area, food is food for school. You stop food today, you won't have children the next week in the school. So we have to feed them. We are being assisted by World Food Program, but of recent, they are getting short of funds, and we are getting more and more children getting out of school if we cannot feed them. So these kind of areas are also giving us a headache in the planning in as far as financing education is concerned. That's as far as challenges are concerned. Now, funding. UPE and USE, we are giving money to schools per head, per child, per student. But this has been running on almost a uniform rate for the so many years we have had these programs. But you remember there is inflation. There are all these other factors that are affecting the funds. And the unit cost is so little. Uganda shilling 7,000 per year per student or per child in primary would translate into less than $3. And this is what we give per child per year. So already this is a problem when it comes to quality. We are, as government, we give textbooks and instructional materials separate. Then government pays the teachers, government trainees the teachers, government looks after the teacher training facilities. All this is big impact on the small resources that we have. And on the national budget, you find that education consumes 14.6. And out of that, 14.6%, primary education takes 50%, secondary takes 31%, and the BTVET takes 6%. Tertiary takes 13%. So primary education takes the biggest chunk. But I've already told you the rate we give per child, less than $3 per year. And that is three terms, meaning each term per child we give $1 for running the school and management of the school. But I've said we construct the classes, we pay the teachers, we also train the teachers, but the running costs at the school, $1 per. So I think it is small. I liked Julia when she gave that model. I could see that it is working well, maybe in Australia, people mainly. I think the literacy rate is so high, so people can go on the web. In Uganda, this will be a failure if you are going to depend on the web, because even radios, in some areas, you will not find people having them. So we send money to the local governments. And then the local governments distribute the money to the schools. That system was creating delays in schools accessing the money. So we have decided these last 2 years to send the money directly to the school. Now we're having a bigger problem of accountability because the local government is saying you are not giving just the money. So how do you want us to account for the money? Let the schools account for the money. But we have got over 15,000 primary schools. So at national level, getting accountability from those schools is a real problem. And the local government are saying, but you are sending the money directly to the school. We shouldn't be the ones to account for the money. Much as I'm saying it is $1 per term, aggregated, it becomes a lot of money. And we need to really have accountability for this money. There are some schools that have got, say, 200 pupils. If you went by only this rate of multiplying by the children in the school, there are those that have got will be disadvantaged because of the smaller numbers. So we have a threshold. Each school to start with has got to get 100,000. Then we have a variable. The balance of the money is given as a variable. How many children do you have in the school? And that one is added on the 100,000 so that we cater for the schools with low enrollments. when it comes to secondary schools, because these are fewer, these ones are given 47,000 per student. And we also give private schools some money. Where government doesn't have secondary schools, government aided in a sub-county, we look for those private schools where we can partner with, which we can partner with and support them. And we give them money so that we help the children in those sub-counties to partake of education where they do not pay. But we have found a big problem of accountability. Now we are like saying, no, why don't we stop this? Go on building slowly in those sub-counties, but not just dish out this money to private providers. This is a big debate in Parliament at the moment.
Yes. Thank you so much, Daniel. Actually, I want to press you on one issue, which is you mentioned you have 14% of your budget currently spent on education. International evidence suggests that governments should aim for about 20%. How hard has it been for you to convince your own government to put more resources into education, and how are you trying to do that?
At the moment, we are going to be beneficiaries of the Global Partnership for Education. But the major concern there was, but in your government, there is decline in the provision for education. Unless you assure us that the trend is going to change, we shall not give you this money in case you... but government is interested in giving more funds. But when you look at the trend, the donor community is also reducing on its provisions. Now, when there is that reduction, of course, with the priorities of government, you find that education cannot escape. They have to encroach on this money for education. It may increase in amount, but nominally you find that it is less than what has been provided before. So we are talking to government, we as technical people, Parliament talks about it, but there is a number of competing priorities. So there is no way we can force government to do this. We only plan, given our provisions, given our requests, but at the end of the day, even when in the budget it is provided for, when those competing priorities overpower them, you'll find that you do not get all the money at the end of the budgeting period. There will be deductions, definitely, to cater for the emerging priorities. And the donor community now says, there is a bit of corruption here, there is a bit of this, so they are not very sure of their money. Now they are changing from the swap arrangement and going the project mode. This is another problem we are facing. They go the project mode, they want their money to go to specific activities.
Thank you. It's very interesting. Harry, I'd like to move on to you with a broader question around the link between spending and education outcomes. And as researchers in the education space, one of the big challenges is we can't really link very well levels of spending with outcomes. The correlation just doesn't seem to be very strong. So I would like to ask you, what's kind of the state of knowledge there, and how do you see money playing a role in terms of equalizing and getting those marginalized children achieving learning outcomes, even if we at an aggregate level don't seem to be able to merely make a case? So I'd be interested to hear what you have to say to that.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. I guess I would start by repeating the question, and I agree that there's a weak link between more education, more spending on education and education outcomes, but I think that's due to how funding is actually implemented. I think often it's not well targeted, it's often misallocated, might not reach the intended beneficiaries, and as we already heard from the Honorable Julia Gillard, decisions are often made without good information about the current system as it is, and often with weak evidence about what works. So what can be done about this? I can give my opinion, but much of what I have to say is really repeating what Julia Gillard said about Australia, which I agreed about. So I think it's just generalizing many of those points that Australia made. So I think there's a question of spending. It's not really spending more or less, but rather how decisions are made about where the resources go. And I think there's good examples of countries that have achieved great results at relatively less spending. I could give the example of Korea, which has produced consistently excellent results and spends on a per student basis half of what Mexico spends on education. So it can be done. The question is, how do we get the balance between spending, the locus of decision making, alignment and evaluation to work together? So on spending, my version of what Elizabeth called the impact model is, I would call it formula funding, which is very much what the Honorable Julia Gillard said in the case of Australia. And I would go further and say that it's not only formula funding, but also money follows students. So we need to target properly, but then make sure that those resources follow the student wherever they are in the education system. At the basic level, ensuring equal access to a school, making sure teachers present, making sure materials readily available is something that should be guaranteed. So the inputs, we need to get the inputs right. More importantly, making sure that students show up, and this could take a variety of measures, demand-side financing, conditional cash transfers, scholarships, vouchers, whatever they're called in a particular context, and where appropriate, school choice. Second, schools need to be more autonomous, appropriately autonomous, and I think there's two areas that I would focus on here. One is involving parents, empowering parents to play a greater role in the school of their children. We have evidence that this works even in very low-income environments. And second is on school management. One area that's been under-researched in the development context is the role of school leadership. This is something we take for granted in many OECD countries, but in most of the countries where we work, there is no system for creating school leaders, and often it's a promoted teacher that takes that role. But we need programs that train and certify school leaders so they can make more decisions, including budgetary decisions, staffing decisions, and appropriate curriculum decisions. Third point is on accountability. I think it's already been mentioned by several people, and it's accountability in the whole system, public, private, whatever the private sector is called in the country, and a model of accountability that's really a no-excuses model. We need to adopt the model that we don't accept failure so that our public resources are actually producing the results that we want, and that is making sure that all children learn through the school system. And in the model of money follows student, we need an accountability system with teeth. Publishing test scores, disseminating the results, using the results to make appropriate decisions is part of this. And test-based accountability can work. We have a very good example from Pakistan, the Punjab Education Foundation, a program that uses tests to promote accountability to improve education outcomes and to get more children into school. My fourth comment is on alignment, and here I think more is needed for disadvantaged populations. We have good evidence about the success in many parts of the world of getting children into school, including minority children, ethnic minorities, indigenous populations, but the results on outcomes is not as good. So in countries where the general population is doing better in terms of jobs, reduction in poverty, minority children tend to still fall behind. The gap tends to grow over time, except in China. China has managed to grow, to reduce poverty, and at a faster rate for the ethnic minority population. But it required more than just school interventions. It requires a development program that encourages more investment so that children leave school with jobs and opportunities. These are models that we need to study and to find out how we can make sure that our resources are working for those populations that need to be targeted and how we can generate the investment in the community so that they have jobs and can come out of poverty once they finish their schooling. The last point I want to make is that the evidence on what works is emerging. We need to continue to invest in this. You can't get to where you want to go if you don't know where you are. So basic information is required, so something like a data revolution, as it's being called. But also we need rigorous evaluation about what works, especially for disadvantaged populations. This is being generated. We're doing great in education, but from a very low base. We need a continued investment in evidence. Thank you.
Yes, thank you so much, Harry. And I actually want to just dig a little deeper into this issue of data and accountability, because I've worked on other sectors as well, and coming into education, I've just been really amazed about how we are not doing a good job on this data front, both in terms of measuring outcomes, in terms of financing data not being available. If you look at the health sector, for example, one tool to sort of look at financing streams is national accounts. In 180 countries in the world, there are institutionalized national health accounts. We don't have any such thing on education. There's several people in the room here who have been trying to look at domestic financing. Where is the money going? We have Save the Children here, UNICEF. We're just struggling to do this. And the question is, what can we do as an international community? I think we just haven't pushed enough. And it also relates to our inability to convince others to put more resources into this, because we're not able to demonstrate inputs related to outputs or outcomes. So I'd be interested to hear from you. What is it we should be doing in this space?
Well, part of it is to continue doing what we've already started. So we do have systems to collect the basic information. I think UNESCO, UIS does a great job at that, and they need to be encouraged to continue this. But even for those data that they are collecting, there's still a lot of gaps, and it's something that we really should focus on. I think part of it is capacity building, part of it is funding, but it's something that we should be asking at every country where we're engaged is what is the information base? And there's just too many gaps. So to address that, we do have a tool that we apply with UNESCO UIS to measure the level of information that's being provided on those basic indicators to UNESCO and what can be done to improve that. But even if we did that well, we'd still be missing some of those components that you mentioned on learning. We don't have enough information on this, and on the financing that or what's going on throughout the country. I want to add a piece of data that I picked up recently. There's an estimate of how much is spent on education globally, and it's $4.5 trillion, and it's forecast to grow to over $6 trillion by 2018. So there's a lot of money going into education, and the important thing is where is it going? Because we hear declines in spending, declines in donor allocation, but the world is spending a lot of money on education. When that's broken down, at least in developed economies, one of the biggest growth areas has been test preparation, so people preparing to take examinations and such. So it's a lot of money, but maybe not exactly where we think it might be going. So another element to getting the more complete data is countries that participated in the OECD's older program, I think it's called World Education Indicators. So non-OECD countries could participate, and they did report on most of the OECD indicators, which would bring us a lot closer to what you said happens in other sectors like health.
Great, thank you very much. I'll now turn to Fazli. Fazli, you're in the process of completing a study on equity and financing in Bangladesh. Like to have you tell us a little bit about that and how you see, first of all, the inequities there, how large are they, and what's the government doing about them, or what are the gaps?
Sure. Thank you very much, Lisbeth. I wanted to start with some data, but now I will start with a small story from one of my school visits, where a small girl, a grade 7 girl, told me that her favorite subject is history. That's not a very common answer, so I thought, okay, I'll explore a bit more. So I asked her, do you know about Mughal period? Do you know when it started in this part of the world? And she, very bright girl, said, yeah, it started last year in grade 6. So that was my learning moment, actually. And that's when I felt, okay, these kids are coming to school, but what are they actually learning? Now, this is not about that particular girl, I mean, what I'm going to tell you about. This is about whole Bangladesh. Bangladesh is a huge country with 18 million, or rather 20 million kids in primary age group. 18 million of them are in the schools. But if you look at the National Students Assessment, when these kids graduate from grade 5, only 25% of them have the required level of competency in mother tongue. And if you consider the 30% dropout before they reach grade 5, that's for every kid who has this competency, there are 5 more kids who doesn't have this competency. I mean, that's a kind of serious picture for Bangladesh. Now, that needs to change very radically. I mean, why? Two things. One is in Bangladeshi constitutions, it is enshrined that, okay, government must provide equal opportunity for all citizens. And they are becoming Bangladeshi citizens, so social justice and that perspective comes into play. The other thing is Bangladesh wants to be a middle-income country in 7 to 10 years' time. And with this level of literacy, it is almost impossible to become a middle-income country with stable and democracy in the country. So that is the backdrop of the study that we started last year. So we wanted to ask three questions. Number one is, so is it possible to develop an indicator that will rank all upazilas, and that is sub-districts in Bangladesh, against the policy goals that Bangladesh wants to achieve in education? Second question was, okay, when you have index, of course, you will have some sub-districts coming at the top, some sub-districts coming at the bottom, and some will be, a majority will be probably in the middle. Is it possible to see what are the demand-side factors and what are the supply-side factors that constitute that ranking? So those were the like basic three questions. So we developed a complex composite indicator with 22 kind of indices in 5 big areas. And those areas are access, quality, outcome, infrastructure, and equity. And we ranked all 500 sub-districts in Bangladesh. We saw a very shocking picture. And the picture is that almost half the sub-districts are not even halfway through to the policy goals in Bangladesh. That is, half the sub-districts, over 300 sub-districts actually, scored less than 50% in that index. And for quality, it's even dire. For half the sub-districts, it's less than 25% score in that index. So this is the kind of first level of findings we have. Then we wanted to look at the demand side and supply side factors. For demand side factor, we did a household survey in 3 most deprived areas. One is the river islands, the Chores in Bangladesh. One is a very big ethnic minority community in the hill tracts region of Bangladesh. And the third one is the urban slums, which are becoming very big in Bangladesh, and education services really, really, really poor in the urban slums. So we did household survey, and we also did focus group discussions. What we found is a very complex picture about what are the kind of bottlenecks for a child to be in a school, continue school, and graduate from a school. It's not only about the availability of school. It's about poverty, where parents really have to decide that, okay, this is not the time for my boy or girl to send to school, partially because of the money is not there, number one. Number two is distance from school. Parents suffer from security. Malnutrition is a big problem. So the age is a big bit of a problem. At age 5, children are not really physically ready to go to a government school. And mothers keep telling us that, okay, when they are at age 8, they will be able to go. So there's a big gap there. And from the household survey, we found that, as the previous panelists say, parents actually do need to pay money. Our out-of-pocket expenditure is almost 25% of those poor household expenditure. And this is for primary government primary schools and sometimes for NGO schools. And that's a shocking picture. So money comes into play. And then in the hill tracts area, we found that mother tongue is a big problem. There are a number of minority ethnic communities who don't speak Bangla, which is the majority language and which is the medium of instruction in Bangladesh. So that was a big problem. Distance to school is a big problem. Security of school, from home to school, is a big problem. And similar problems we found in the Chores, where we had found that girls' early marriage is a big problem. Girls are taken out of school at grade 5 or 6 for early marriage. And there are perfect social reasons for early marriage. You go and talk to the parents, you go and talk to the community, the kind of justifications they say, you feel in that context, okay, this is the best decision they are making, actually. Because in school, girls are not safe. The kind of literacy and numeracy they will get, they'll probably not get a job. So what to do? Parents take that decision. So these are the kind of complex pictures we found. Then we looked at the finance side, which is the supply side. And we found, shockingly, or not so shockingly for many of us, there's quite a flat and a very kind of simple formulaic-based allocation, which doesn't even consider the number of children in a particular sub-district. It is based on number of children who are in schools, and that's basically it. The number of children in school, how many children are there, how many teachers should be provided, how many classrooms should be there, how many textbooks should be there. That's basically it. So that's the basic expenditure of government. Apart from that, there are two other small, relatively new initiatives which are a bit more flexible. One is the stipend. The other one is a school-level grant. But again, a school-level grant is flat for all schools. But we thought it is a compromise because it is the second year of the school-level grant, and there are all kinds of accountability problems you have mentioned, Daniel, are there because the money directly goes to a school. So it is moving. But these are the only two flexible instruments where government can actually make some arrangements for the most neediest area. So our key finding is that, okay, so you have a complex picture of the problem, but you have a kind of very flat picture of the solution that are coming from the government. In some areas, community provide a lot of support to schools and where schools are doing really good. But that's not public finance. That's coming from private finance. And that picture is not clear, and that's one of the kind of major shortcomings of the study, which I will try to kind of address very soon. But that, apart from that, in most of the schools, in most of the communities, it is only what comes from the government that matters. And government is not providing for that complex picture, that the factors that really cause inequity in Bangladesh. I'll stop there.
Yeah. Great. Thank you so much, Fazli. And there's a lot more to come from this study, and we look forward to continuing working with you. I'd like to come back to you, Julia, and actually ask you a question now with your other hat of the new chair for the Global Partnership for Education. And the question is around how donors can make sure that they use their very scarce amount of money to unlock and leverage the big pot of money, and what role you think they could be playing in really opening up the whole discussion around allocations and spending of domestic resources.
Thank you for that question. Once again, I'm not going to pretend to be an expert in GPU work at this very, very early stage where the appointment hasn't even really commenced. But I think Daniel in some ways raised these issues during his contribution. The approach that GPE has taken and is continuing to take is that its donor funds do need to be viewed as leverage associated with domestic government financing so that we maximise change, so that we don't see a substitution effect where donor dollars go in and domestic financing dollars go out, but also so we maximise the effectiveness of every dollar that's being spent on domestic education. I think some of the things that can help with that, one, the GPE model requires the development of an education sector plan that brings everybody together to work through the approach, and that's not just the approach to the GPE expenditure but to all expenditure in education. I think it's important to have that sense of coming together and buy-in. Second, I think there's a role where GPE can help work with countries on this data collection question, which is common right across all of the contributions. And if we had better information, then everybody, donors and domestic governments and private philanthropists, could make better selections about what to do. So I think they're elements of it, but not in any way a complete solution, and more work and more discussion like this discussion's necessary.
Yes. Great. Thank you so much. So I would like to open it to the audience now. I will take some questions. If you could introduce yourself, I think the mics will be coming around.
Thank you very much for great presentations. I'm Manzoor Ahmed from Bangladesh, BRAC University. I think it would be recognized by all of you from what we heard that all education is really partnership in a way, public-private partnership, whether even if it is government school, parents are paying quite a bit, directly, indirectly. In Bangladesh, it is, as Fazlur described, very low investment and uneven and so on. And the parents are, in a way, trying to make up for this so that some kind of education system keeps going. And that's true, I think, Australia and other countries. So the question is, when we talk about resource allocation and better use, I think we cannot look at just at the government investment, but the total picture of resources that are being invested. And that is the reality, and we shouldn't say that, well, the government money is what counts and others don't. I think so. How look at the total investment picture and how the leverage that you brought about, how the yes. donor money and GPE particularly yes. can help in this area.
Great.
How the partnership can be built in the right way here, GPE, the partnership,
yes.
with the right kinds of it's right now it is ELCG and the government, but the other actors, NGOs, civil society and so on, and decentralization, school level work. So how that can be encouraged.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, I think it's very important to raise the question about the complete picture. Thank you for that. Yes, gentlemen.
Steve Cleese, University of Maryland. I have one question for Harry and one for Julia. For Harry, in the view of many, the World Bank has, for decades, underemphasized the need for more resources for education and overemphasize the gains to be gotten from reallocating resources. My question is, isn't there a lot of research, maybe research you disagree with, that shows that money does matter, that specific inputs matter to education, expensive ones like teachers, and for that's all for quality. And for access, it's clear money matters where we need more teachers, more classrooms, lower class sizes. And you know, parents say money matters by voting with their feet. They send their children to schools that have more resources. And for Julia, my question is a short one, a variant of what I asked the last panel. Isn't there a danger? The financing model is very interesting, but isn't there a danger of focusing only on two of the many outcomes you want out of education to build a finance model when we want to offer a holistic education for our children? Yes. Thank you.
One more, Joe.
Thanks, Elizabeth, and thank you to the panel. Joe Bourne, UNICEF. I'm going to sort of focus a little bit on the, you know, what's really going to make a difference here in terms of investing in equity in education. I mean, my sense is that we have, as a community, an increasingly strong case around the investment case for education from an economic, social, and health perspective. I think we have plenty of stories and data coming up now, although more can come, on how finance for education is often not equitable. And it does disadvantage particular students in particular situations. And I think we have some examples, and Julia's example from Australia is a very good one, of how education finance can be made more equitable with policies such as loading and looking at particular sets of and particular data sets around disadvantage. What I'm less sure of is whether we have a good grasp on what it actually is costing countries to maintain these types of disparities. Do we know what it's costing them, both in terms of access in learning for the future, for their future economic growth, for the future health of their nations, for the future social benefits? And I'm not sure also if we have enough examples of how equity-focused policies are not just good for the children who are currently disadvantaged, but actually good for the system more broadly. And that's something that we in UNICEF are trying to do some more simulations on equity and education financing to try to get a better grip of that. So my kind of question really is what does the panel think are the incentives, both for governments at one end of the scale, but also for the private sector, and the Punjab Education Foundation, I think, is a good example here. What are the incentives to actually start to address equity more robustly, both through more financing, but also through redirecting financing?
Great, thank you. Well, we have a lot to discuss. So I think there's a direct question to the World Bank, so maybe Harry could start with that and then take on any of the other questions you want to respond.
Well, I don't agree that we underemphasize the need for resources. In fact, what I said was that we need to make sure that the inputs were there for children to attend school. My point was that it's not a question of more or less spending. It's how the resources are allocated, and if a case could be made that more resources would improve the outcomes we have, we're all for it. This is what we do every day. My point about where the resources go, so we even had a couple of examples about where countries are putting their resources, and mentioning the case of how much goes to primary schooling. So I think the question is, how do we know that that's an appropriate amount? What is it the outcome that we're trying to get, and what are the what is the total picture, which is also the question that came from Mr. Ahmed from BRAC. I agree that we don't have a total picture in most countries, but that would be very helpful. I want to reiterate that Joe's point on the need for more analysis about the cost of I guess inequity would be the point. We know the benefits of education. Therefore, what are we not getting by having a high level of inequality, and Joe mentioned the model on the simulations for education equity, and that's one tool that we're working with UNICEF to help us get a better picture on the situation and what can be done about it. So that model helps cost the alternatives for improving access and equity based on evidence about what works, and something that we've tried in a few countries, and it's worth exploring. And I also wanted to give a plug to our SABER, our systems approach for better education results, and our new domain, which is on equity and inclusion, and we hope to address this question much more thoroughly. One last point on the cost of education, something that Mr. Ahmed mentioned, that one of the costs that we take for granted is what parents and children are giving. So the biggest cost is the time that children are in school, and if they're not learning, that's not a very good use of their time. And I think that's what Fazal was getting at, when these alternative uses of children's time might be quite rational from the parents' perspective. So until we get the education to a high enough quality, we will have that problem.
Yes. Daniel, I wonder whether you'd like to come in on this question around the cost of inaction and to what extent your government, you feel, the cost of inaction or the cost of having sustained inequities, to what extent is in your government, is there a realization that if those inequities continue to exist, that that is actually going to cost you in terms of future development, economic growth, all sorts of health outcomes, and so on.
Thank you. These inequities, there is one area where we have not paid a lot of attention, is the rural-urban, the difference in performance. You find that in rural areas, the parents are not as active. They are not playing a big role in the education of their children as much as the urban parents. So there is that divide, which has also come up. and it is very vivid, and all statistics indicate that urban schools are performing much better than rural, and the basic the reason is the parents' participation. Government is aware of this. We are trying to do all we can. We are trying to sensitize the parents, but it's not forthcoming because the number of parents who, when they were told there is universal primary education, there is universal secondary education, so their duty remained to produce children and then send them to school. You know, they are no longer paying a lot of attention on this. So I think it's a lot of effort that we need to put in, and we are not yet succeeding. But it is a big, big problem because these are the children who compete unfavorably with their colleagues in other areas. Then when we come to the children who are disabled, there are still problems of parents hiding them. They do not want to bring them out so that they are known. You put them, and you know in our data we have so many. The number we have is much smaller than what is actually on the ground. So this is also still a problem because we cannot have the right data to see how to. So government is trying all the best we can in order to provide for the equity issues. But on the other side, we have succeeded in that girl-boy children are now, there is that 50-50 now. At primary, at secondary, and at university, the girls' children are coming up so well. So on that front, we are succeeding. But when it comes to these other inequities, we are not yet there.
Great. Julia, maybe you would like to take the question on the too many variables. Is there too much of a good thing in this space?
Look, I don't think so. I mean, in terms of learning outcomes, the reality is we don't know how to measure everything, but we can measure some things, and I think we should measure the things that we can measure. So, you know, we're measuring in Australia literacy and numeracy. We'll move on to the measurement of science. Of course, I'm well aware that schools are doing a broad range of other things to develop students and their capabilities. But at the end of the day, if kids are coming out of Australian schools at the end of their compulsory education and they cannot read, write or perform mathematics, then that's a problem. And whatever they're going to do in life, no matter how creative or, you know, whatever functions they're going to perform, literacy and numeracy will be core to those functions. We had a lot of this debate in Australia, and one of the ways that it resolved was when you go onto the My School website, every school gets the opportunity to describe itself and what it values as its learning journey in a few hundred words at the front of the website. So if you click on an individual school, you'll get that first. And it might well say that it's always focused on the, you know, resilience capabilities of its students, or it's always focused on drama and is the school of choice for children who want to end up in the dramatic arts. But whatever else that school is doing, we do want that school to be teaching kids to read and write and do maths, which is why we measure it. On the composite of the variables of need, once again, you know, you end up making choices here, but we, through a painstaking process involving a battery of statisticians and regression analysis and all the rest of it, identified off our pretty good data sets, not perfect, but pretty good data sets, the variables that made a difference to the advantages or disadvantages that children brought to school, and selected those variables to help us work out what the website should display about the level of advantage or disadvantage in the school, and what the capacity to pay curve should be, should consist of in terms of parental contribution versus government contribution for non-government schools.
Great. I will take one more question. Barbara, that's fantastic. If you could...
Thanks. I'm Barbara Bruns from the World Bank. I had a question for Julia. You know, you focused a lot about the information that you're generating at the level of the school, which is fantastic. But that also should give you the ability to aggregate that information at the level of the states, which I understand have a fair amount of independence in their policies in Australia. So you could be also monitoring states' comparative performance in improving and what they're doing differently. I've seen the experience in Brazil where the investment in a national database that generates school-level data has actually had this huge dividend in allowing municipalities to compare themselves to each other and allowing states to compare themselves to each other. And it's really kind of stimulated a looking over your shoulder for innovations and a diffusion of innovation. I'm just wondering if you think that has also been happening in Australia.
Yes, it has. We actually had state-by-state data before we – state-by-state data for public schools, not for private schools, had it before we had the school-by-school data. It fueled, a lively competitive – actually, it's interesting because we've got a lot of state-based newspapers and you would on one day be able to pick up the newspaper in New South Wales, Victoria and Queensland, and the different editions would all be telling you that their state came out the highest in this data. So they'd pick the one selective, you know, Victoria did better in English, New South Wales did better in maths, Queensland did better in most improved, and they're apparently all winners. But at the policy level, yes, of course, it got people looking over the border to see what other jurisdictions were doing better. Mostly, though, it was fairly predictable in that those states with higher Indigenous populations and those states historically home to more poverty, by Australian standards, which obviously is a first world sort of definition of poverty, but it would basically replicate that, you know, the Northern Territory would always come out with a lower set of results than, say, Victoria because of the percentage of Indigenous kids in remote locations who were not getting a good education, even though they were capable of achieving highly if they got a good education. So the finer grained data has made a big difference for us. What that is fueling is buddying up of high-performing schools with low-performing schools. That's a system that happens organically, but also a system which we have pushed, particularly in Indigenous education, where through a program we call Stronger Smarter, high-performing schools with large numbers of Indigenous children buddy up with low-performing schools to share best practice and to try and make a difference to the lower-performing school.
Yes, thank you very much. I think what's come out of this panel is really the issue of data and accountability. And so in closing, I just wanted to ask the other panelists, what's the chance of a my school in your country? Or for Harry, what's the chance of my school in World Bank countries? Daniel, 10 years from now, will we have a my school with learning data, financial data, like we had in Australia, online? You think it's possible?
We are putting...
Briefly.
we are putting emphasis on data collection and quality of data. We are using Agile, which I think many people know, to see that we improve on this. And I think we shall be there.
Great. Fazli, what do you think? Bangladesh?
Well, the data is there, to be honest. It's about analysis and communication. I think we're getting there. So in 10 years' time...
Great.
Personally,
and the world picture, Harry?
Yes.
Great. Thank you so much for attending this session. Please join me in thanking this excellent panel. I would now like to invite you all to join us for a lunch. The lunch will be served on the side here, so if you go through the side doors, you will find something to eat. Thank you very much.